Good evening, James McCann here with My Science Hour, March 30th, 2017. Tonight is a special broadcast regarding the science, the so-called science of global warming. Now, I'm doing this for a reason because this will be heard, this will be passed around to other groups, including news agencies, who are struggling with this issue. Let me just summarize it in one sentence, and then there are many issues here. I'll go through the actual science of this. But for 30 years or more, the global warming, global climate change, greenhouse effect, carbon dioxide enthusiasts or scientists, government paid typically, have been putting out incorrect information. And now we also know recently that there have been studies showing they've actually falsified data. But what I'm talking about is the central core issue of stating that the temperature of Earth is increasing. And what I'm going to point out is that temperature is not the issue. And I'll just make a very simple case here. Temperature and heat are two very different things. They're using these terms interchangeably. So when they're talking about global warming, they're talking about the heat content or the amount of energy or heat that's contained in our atmosphere, oceans, etc. The temperature really has nothing to do with this. So a small increase in temperature over a 50-year period or something is not what is involved in the global energy equation. Temperature is a single measurement, like humidity. That would be like saying the humidity is rising, therefore we're going into a greenhouse effect or something. Temperature is one of the properties that we measure when we talk about air. Or temperature of the water or some medium of the earth itself. But temperature is the wrong entity to be measuring. And I'll give a couple of quick examples here. Let's take two boxes, one great big box, great, great big box, and one just regular size box that fits on your table. And let's say that they're filled with air, pretty much the same air composition. Let's put apples for apples. And we measure the temperature in the little box, and we measure the temperature in the big box. And let's say they're the same. They turn out to be the same. Which box has more heat in it? Which box has more energy, in other words? Heat is a measure of energy, the amount of stored energy in the box. Well, the little box, we could calculate the amount of energy, the little molecules moving around, etc. We could calculate or we could measure or estimate the amount of energy in the little box. In other words, the heat content, the amount of heat that's contained in the box, the amount of energy that's contained in the box. And then we go to the big box. It has many, 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 many times more. The quantity of heat or energy contained in the box is much greater, yet they have the same temperature. Now, understand that heat, let's take another experiment here. These are thought experiments. Let's take two boxes on your table or on your desk that are exactly the same size, exactly the same composition of air and chemicals in the air or moisture, humidity, etc. They're exactly the same inside in these boxes now, exactly the same size. Okay? And we measure their temperatures, and we find that the temperatures are exactly the same. Now we're going to do something in one box. We're going to lower the humidity down to amount of about zero, let's say, 0% humidity. So one box has normal humidity, normal water vapor content, and the other box has no water vapor content at all. And we measure, both boxes still have the same temperature. Which box has more energy? Well, the box with that has the water content. It has humidity in it. Now we're going to do something. We're going to raise the temperature in the box that has no humidity. We're going to raise it. We're going to raise it quite a bit. And now you ask the question, which box has more heat content? And it turns out that up to quite a large temperature increase, the box that has humidity has more energy. It has more heat content than the same size box that does not, but has a higher temperature. So the box that has the higher temperature has lower heat content. Do you see what I mean? The temperature reading is like, I'm going to give another example. Another example of using a false metric. You're driving down the road in your car, and you decide, now let's talk about speedometer, for example. The speedometer is hooked. It's a cable that comes from your dashboard where you have the little meter that tells you how fast you're going. And it goes down to the transmission, and it measures the number of revolutions per minute, etc. And it translates it into kilometers per hour or miles per hour that you read on your speedometer. Okay. Now let's say you get the bright idea, like the global climate change scientists have, and you're going to put on top of your car a little wind vane. And you're going to hook that up to your speedometer instead of this hard cable that goes down to your transmission. And you're going to say, that's how you want to measure the velocity of your car. So you're driving down the road, and you're going into a 30-mile-an-hour wind, and you're going 30 miles an hour. That wind velocity shows 60 miles an hour. Or conversely, say you're going down the road at 60 miles an hour, and you have a tailwind of 30 miles per hour. Your wind vane speedometer on the top of your car is only going to tell you you're going 30 miles per hour. Okay? Or let's do it this way. Let's say you're heading into a headwind. Your real velocity measured with the transmission cable is 60 miles per hour, but you're going into a headwind of 30 miles per hour, and it reads, your wind velocity reads 90 miles per hour. So you back off and you're going, you want to go 60 miles per hour. So really, to go 60 miles per hour with your wind vane, you have to go 30 miles an hour in reality. And so let's pretend you're driving down the road, you've got a 30 mile an hour tailwind, and according to your wind speedometer, you're going 60 miles per hour. The cop stops you, pulls you over, and says, you were speeding. You were going 90 in a 60 zone. And you said, no, I was going 60 miles an hour. I read it on my speedometer. And you understand that you were going 90 miles an hour relative to the road, but 60 miles an hour relative to the wind. That's an example of using the wrong measurement parameter to judge what you're doing, the scientific measurement. That's an example. So let's return back to the concept of telling people that the temperature is going to increase if you keep driving your SUV up and down the road. Well, there's a lot of bad science involved here. But temperature, or a rise in temperature over a period of time, they're talking about climate change. Now, let's take a look at this. If you're gathering data, now if you are in your car, you have one data point, it's your car, and it's the velocity of that car. But if we're talking about the global temperature of the world, now, I've already pointed out that temperature is one reading. We have temperature, we have humidity, we have atmospheric pressure, we have all kinds of other readings relative to the atmosphere. So to pick just one, which is temperature, is not taking, it's ridiculous. Because when you add all these factors together, you end up with a quantity that's called heat content. or energy, the amount of energy stored in the atmosphere, in the ocean, and there's a dynamic exchange between these. If you were to take this seriously and not be lazy scientists who stick a thermometer out the window and go, well, it looks a little warmer today, what you would have to do is take all of the various properties of the atmosphere, not only at sea level or out at the airport or downtown at the weather station, but you would have to take it at high altitudes, and you would have to take data points all around the world, because on a given day, you might have more humidity in Kansas, and the next day, it's very dry. So taking the temperature in Kansas City one day when there's a lot of moisture, and then taking it the next day when there's not a lot of moisture, that temperature reading does not mean the same thing. It does not mean the same thing. And so let's look at something that's in true science. If this were done scientifically, according to real scientific methods, you would have to measure all the various properties that contribute to the heat content. That includes the composition of the air, the humidity, the atmospheric pressure, and temperature is one of the readings that you would take, not the only one. Okay, so what I have to talk about now is something called the Earth's heat equation. Now, if it gets out of balance, if we have more heat or an excess source of heat coming into Earth, then that could potentially cause what we might call global warming. But the first question is, do we even have climate? Did we have climate stabilized before? And the answer is no. The very simple answer is that we depend on solar light input and electrical energy input, something that modern meteorology does not even include. We have vast amounts of electrical energy, it's called joule heating, coming into the atmosphere every day. Now, to understand the heat equation of Earth, we would have to have data points all over the Earth, hundreds of thousands of them feeding into a giant computer bank and up in the atmosphere. And the scientists simply do not have this. What are they doing? They're measuring temperature, which is only one of the parameters relative to the heat content of air. It's only one of the many, many that would have to be measured. And then where do they put their thermometers? At the airport? Well, the airport is typically 5 degrees warmer than 5 miles away out in the countryside, for the simple reason that you have all that cement there. So you have a high heat content due to the cement. It, like if you live next to the ocean or a big, big lake, you will have a cooling effect in the summer and a warming effect in the winter because that big body of water is there. And so that is a way of maintaining temperature that's near the ocean. And so typically, that's why people like to live near the ocean. If it's a cold climate or if it's a warm climate, you get a benefit from living near the ocean. It cools you down in the hot climates, and it warms you up in the cold climates. And but anyway, this term climate is a fictitious term. We have never on this planet had in recent history what you would call a stable climate. We had an ice age within the last 10,000 years where a large group of animals died off, the woolly mammoths, the saber-toothed tiger, etc., large animals which had lived on Earth for a very long time because they became large. And all of a sudden, they died off. And I'm not going to get into theories about why there are ice ages or what the mechanism for dying off was, or even the mechanism for creating ice ages, because that would divert the argument. But the simple reality is we are warming up out of an ice age. And in my weather book, the Principia Meteorologia, the Physics of Sun, Earth, Weather, written for the general public, by the way, I explain all of the parameters and effects of coming out of an ice age. And one of them is that as the Earth slowly warms up from the ice age, the ice age, remember, we had an influx of water in the form of glaciers, and they covered a good part of the northern and southern hemispheres. And as they receded, they in their glaciated state, they reflect the sunlight off into outer space, and so the Earth in those regions remained cooler. But slowly, as they began to recede, the Earth began to warm up, and the glaciers, the great glaciers, most of them are gone now. So you go out to the great American parks out in the American West, or you go to Europe, the great glaciers that were in the mountains, etc., are pretty much gone. There's still remnants of them, but not in their original state. So as the glaciers recede, the sunlight hits the Earth, warms it up more than if the glaciers were there, and then causes more receding of the glaciers. And so the end effect is that as we warm up out of an ice age, and that's what we're doing right now, the global warming that we're experiencing, we're actually getting back to normal. And then in my work, what I understood was that as the Earth warms up, it actually overshoots a bit the normal climatic conditions of Earth, and then it drops down and stabilizes. And that's where we are today. There are many other factors here, so I'll be talking about thermodynamics properties. Let's talk about direct heating. Direct heating, here's another instance in which global climate change scientists are completely missing the boat. Imagine, this is as an analogy, you have a nail. And there's two people that are going to try and hammer this nail into a board. One with a great big hammer. And another one with a little teeny, 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 teeny hammer. And which one is going to hammer the nail into the board the fastest? Have the greater effect? Well, clearly you would say the person with the bigger hammer, which is true. Because the person with the little hammer can be there tap, 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 tap all day long and not move that nail hardly at all. So let's look at your automobile. You're driving down the road in your automobile. The greenhouse global warming scientists say that that carbon dioxide coming out the tailpipe is going to, this is after it cools down and everything, the carbon dioxide that's burned in the burning process of gasoline or diesel fuel, is going to increase in the atmosphere and over the long term cause global warming. Well, we'll talk about the greenhouse. You notice that nobody mentions the greenhouse effect anymore. They very subtly sidestep that because the greenhouse effect has been thoroughly proven to be incorrect science. So they don't talk about that. They don't want to rely on that because real scientists would pop up and say, hey, the greenhouse effect doesn't work. But they're still relying on it subtly and in the background. But let's get back to your automobile. You're driving your automobile down the road and your engine is very hot because you're burning fuel in it. The amount of heat being generated, this is called direct heating, the amount of heating in your engine at that time is like the big mallet trying to hit the nail. And the global climate change greenhouse effect due to carbon dioxide coming out your tailpipe is the little teeny hammer, but there's a catch to it because the little teeny hammer in global warming doesn't occur for 10 to 20 years. The direct heating is happening now. So global climate change, people cannot explain, nor do they even try to explain, where all the heat goes that's coming off your engine right now. Let's look at a nuclear power plant. 95% of the heat created in the nuclear process is lost in heat. It goes directly into the atmosphere. But let's take a look at a coal-burning power plant, because there are studies that show that the nuclear plants give off as much carbon dioxide as a coal-burning plant. So that's why I wanted to mention that. A lot of people don't understand that little fact. But let's look at a coal-burning plant. You're taking an inert object, coal, that by itself has no inherent energy. You have to burn it in a fire, basically, in a generator, electrical generator. Between the burning and the conversion to electricity, there's about a 75% heat loss. That heat goes directly into the atmosphere. That's direct heating. The carbon dioxide that's coming out the chimney and then goes into the atmosphere, once again, is like the little teeny hammer, but once again, like the automobile, it's not going to have an effect, alleged effect, for another 5 to 10 years. Okay, in terms of accumulating heat in the atmosphere. So even playing the devil's advocate and saying, okay, global warming people, greenhouse effect, just imagine that it even works, which it doesn't. But even imagine that it did. It has no comparison to direct heating that's coming out of coal power plants, automobiles, buses, trains that are burning coal or diesel fuel, and natural phenomena like volcanoes. A single volcano can contribute more CO2 and so-called global warming gases in a single afternoon than all the cars in the history of the world. All the cars, buses, trains put together in the history of the world. So something is amiss here. The end result is that extremely bad science has been used by scientists that are basically tier two scientists. The real issue is pollution. The real issue is pollution. You notice that the climate change people never talk about direct heating. They never talk about reforestation. I'll be talking about cutting trees and changing the environment in a minute. Desertification, the creation of desert by cutting down all living things. And I just saw an article in CNN where they're trying to promote global warming. And they're talking about Sudan in Africa. Well, the people cut down all of the trees, all of the living matter there, and they're left with nothing, and they blame it on global climate change. No, these are countries that are in severe, dire poverty with exploding populations and have used up all of the natural resources. That's the problem in Sudan. The global warming, the real causes of global warming, just let me just step through these. We're coming out of an ice age. We're warming up to normal. The last time the world really had what you might call climate was when the mastodons were living on Earth. Another period was during the reign of the dinosaurs. We know that Earth had a relatively stable climate, but here's another point. Earth's atmosphere has been changed drastically on many occasions. During the time of the dinosaurs, Earth was warm all over its entire surface, had luscious plant life. Look at where they find dinosaur bones out in Wyoming or in the Dakotas or in Montana. Do you think there's enough vegetation to support a herd of dinosaurs in those locations? No, a lot of the places where you find these are in severely dry areas. So clearly, the climate that is there right now is not the climate that was abundantly there with moisture and abundant plant life, etc., when the dinosaurs lived there millions of years ago. So we are coming out of an ice age. That's the number one cause of global warming that we are experiencing. Direct solar input. The sun's energy comes in every day, but also we're getting electrical energy that's put into our atmosphere, the cause of the winds, the jet streams, etc. Every day we're getting an input of electrical energy from the solar environment, and nobody includes that in meteorology at all. I have in my work, but in standard meteorology or climatology, they don't include that contribution because all they're doing is sticking a thermometer out the window, the laziest form of science I have ever imagined. They don't talk about direct heating or natural sources or other effects like desertification. So global warming, is there such a thing as global warming? Yes. We are experiencing a climate change on Earth, but it's due to other factors. It's not due to people driving their SUVs around. The problem with global climate change is that they're trying to attribute to one cause and ignoring the other. And so the pollution, this is the real problem, that pollution is being allowed, and they want to say, oh, we have to cut emissions by the year 2025 or some date. I got a kick out of Merkel and Obama got together with the G9 and they had an accord, and they said they're going to cut emissions by 50% by the end of the century. Hey, boys and girls, that's 85 years away, 83 years away. So that's not really something that they're serious about, obviously. But it allows the polluters to continue polluting unabated. And while this squabble over global warming continues, the reality is the global warming people in their 30 to 40 years of harping have not solved any problems. In fact, they've helped the polluters pollute. They've sidetracked the issue, and a lot of people are waking up to this fact that we have more pollution today than ever, in spite of the so-called fleets of scientists out there claiming there's global warming. So the issue is that we do have climate change, we do have global warming. The climates of the United States, etc., are changing, but with the BP oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico and the stoppage of the Gulf Stream, which fed the Mid-Atlantic current stream up to England and the Scandinavian countries and to northern Russia, etc. With that stopping, the climate of those regions has drastically changed, and they were affected by an ocean current, not global warming. The real issue here is we have to stop pollution. So the global warming people are jumping up and down saying, no, we have to stop global warming. But it's become a political football, and it's allowed politicians to ignore the real issue of pollution and allow it to go on by the year 2030, we're going to be reducing emissions when it's not the cause at all. It's the pollution. Nobody talks about this one little fact, that we're directly burning oxygen in coal plants and automobiles. And by the way, we just happen to need oxygen on a daily basis. The level of oxygen in Earth's atmosphere today is half of what it was in the early 1900s. So pollution is the real issue. And so when Trump, for example, cut 34% of the EPA's budget and told the global warming people to get out of Dodge, I fully agree with that. It's 100% the correct thing to do because they have provided bad science, bad results based on bad science. And the idea somehow that the carbon, that the government is going to reduce carbon emissions and somehow save you. Let's go to another point. The United Nations and the governments of the world have colluded to use global warming as a control mechanism. Why? To control water, to control the ownership of water. My book, Water goes into details on how this works. The United Nations Agenda 21 and other agendas also use the global warming, global climate change mantra to control water rights around the world. The Royal Bank of Canada, the Bushes have bought up vast amounts of property in South America over reservoirs, some of the largest water reservoirs in the world. People like Buffett and other people have made a lot of money by garnering water rights and using water rights. For example, in the Oglala Reservoir that is underwater or underground in all the way from Winnipeg down to Texas. When I see government-paid scientists whining because their research is being cut, the problem is government-supported science is exactly that. And what I've learned is if you wanted a group of scientists to say the moon is made of green cheese, all you'd have to do is put out government money and you would have fleets of scientists lining up to tell you that the moon was made of green cheese and all their studies would point in that direction. Because these scientists, that's the only place they're going to get a job. I've gone to scientific meetings, thousands of scientists meeting from around the world. And a woman looked at my badge and she goes, my badge said independent scientist. And she goes, what does that mean, independent scientist? I said, well, that's, I fund my own research. I develop my own funding sources. And I do my own research, et cetera. And she goes, well, how could you possibly work as a scientist without the government and government funding? They don't understand it. They, scientists used to work in laboratories. When Dwight D. Eisenhower left office, he gave his famous speech about the military-industrial complex. But if you listen to the speech, he spent about 2 minutes talking about the military-industrial complex and the danger of it controlling government and wars, etc. But he spent about 10 minutes talking about the government control of science, not so commonly known. But listen to Eisenhower's entire speech. He dwells for a good 10 minutes talking about how scientists were once independent, they worked in a laboratory or a small facility, they were interested in a topic, they were trying to discover principles of nature. But once government got involved with funding, with the peer review process, and by the way, I just saw a publication showing that a high percentage of peer review publications do not follow the scientific method. And I've been saying that for years. The inner group of people get their articles rubber stamped, and people not from the inner group don't get theirs even reviewed or published at all. So the journals, the so-called respectable peer-reviewed journals, are nothing more than a clubhouse to maintain the people that are getting government money. There's a myth that if you increase government spending on science, that you will get an increase in scientific results, and that's simply false. What you will get is a monopoly that's even more locked in place than what you had before. That's what you will get with increased government spending. So there's a complete fallacy regarding so-called respectable peer-reviewed journals. I have articles published in peer-reviewed journals, in astrophysics journals, in high-level astrophysics journals. And I don't do that anymore. I don't play that game. I have a subpage on my webpage talking about peer review, the webpage jmccsci.com, the subpage called peer review, and I'm very critical there. I also give 10 reasons why I personally do not submit work to peer review journals, even though I do have peer reviewed papers from early in my career. So let me go back to a topic that I breached a little bit. I want to go into depth. Trees are, if you looked at an area that's forested and then you cut down the trees, now this has happened a lot in the Amazon jungle, it's happened in the United States. The United States was once covered with forests. Ohio, Indiana, those areas were once Kentucky. When the first pioneers went out there, Davy Crockett and Daniel Boone and those pioneers, when they first went out there, that was woods. That was solid, old-growth woods, and they had to start cutting the trees down enough to make a garden, and then eventually to the point of today where they've cut down fence post to fence post and literally farm it with intensive farming, modern farming techniques. But I've been in places where the climate has changed due to cutting trees. And the reason is because the trees absorb all of that solar energy. They turn it into carbon-based material that eventually you could burn in a fire. But they absorb that energy. They keep it cooler. They maintain the moisture underneath and allow the plants underneath to prosper. But the end result is if you cut down all of the trees, which has been done in many parts of the world now, if you cut down all of the trees, you're going to increase the climate. And this is even on a very local basis. Say you went out to the woods and today and you could find a place where there was 160 acres of solid woods. You went and you build your house out in the middle. It's nice and cool. In the summertime, etc., it's very pleasant. But all of a sudden, you cut down all the trees. That area around your house is going to remain warmer because you have cut down the trees that absorb energy, that breathe, that contribute oxygen to your environment. And you basically have changed your local climate. So cutting trees on a global scale, using wood for construction, really, we've gotten to the point on the planet where enough is enough. They should not be cutting more forests any place on Earth. We should be using earth materials, earth-based materials, block, etc., for building and construction. And, of course, now there are aluminum and other forms of beams that can be used to support roofs and structures so that we don't have to use the quantity of wood that we've been using in the past. I was in an area one time and asked a person who had lived in this area. It was on the area near the equator. And I said, what was it like when you were a child here? This would have been probably 50 years earlier. He said it was much colder and the always would be fog in the morning across the valley. And it would not be until 10 o'clock in the morning till it warmed up to any reasonable level. Now it's warm during the middle of the night. And the reason, I said, what do you attribute this to? He said, cutting down all the trees. He said, as you cut down the trees, they could tell that the climate was changing. So if global climate change, people want to get up a banner and start talking about real issues, they should be talking about preservation of the forests of the world. The other half of that is a lot of times what you put is cement. If you have a city, for example, you put the cement there and it absorbs energy and it maintains a warmer temperature. And so by putting down cement, not only cutting the trees, but putting down cement or hardened building materials, you are changing the climate. So all of these go into actual climate change. I know people that live in wooded areas, in fact, entire states that are highly wooded, but they're experiencing global climate change also. But literally, we have many factors that are contributing to the real issue of climate change. One of the other issues that has to be reversed is education. The global warming scientists have become so dominant, and the government has become so dominant, and so they go hand in hand in education. So your kids are being force-fed global climate change at the school level. If you look at any of the government programs, the first thing they talk about in most of them is global climate change and relating to carbon, etc., carbon dioxide, carbon monoxide being burned as a byproduct of high energy content fuels. Which brings up the next topic. High energy content fuels. What is that? That's nuclear fuel. That's coal. That's any petroleum-based product, which would be diesel, gasoline, oil, as it's burned in ships, etc., crude oil. The world has been stuck in a rut that is mental. The idea that you have to burn high energy content fuel to produce energy. Or the idea that you have to produce heat at all from any source, from sunlight or whatever at all, to produce energy. This is simply a myth. But we are so dependent on high energy content fuels. These are inert substances, materials that you dig up from the earth, oil, the carbon, the coal, etc., and then you burn it. So you're burning oxygen, one of the main components that we need in the atmosphere, turning it into carbon dioxide. And there is a myth that's been promulgated that we have to burn high energy content fuels, and that's the only alleged way that we can propel our mechanized society, our energized society. The real solution is with wind. And so this, I want to give people a little bit of positive hope here. I've developed what will be someday the unique and only source of energy on the planet Earth, and it's called the wing generator, which on a large scale, it's scalable. We can build these to replace nuclear and coal-based power plants. And eventually enough of them where electric trains, automobiles, motorcycles, and even airplanes will be driven by electrical energy from the wind, converted from the wind. And the beauty of the wind is that it's a form of heat energy. The wind is a form of heat energy, very concentrated. But then when you get done using the energy, it gets released back to the environment. You don't burn anything. You don't burn oxygen. It doesn't contribute heat. It doesn't take an inert substance and burn it to create heat and then create steam, which then gets put in a very inefficient process to convert electricity and then shipped over long distances via wire, where it is then consumed. The reason I got started on this entire topic in my own career, probably 12 years ago or more from the time I'm doing this lecture, was to do an overall end-to-end efficiency study for one of the large energy producers. And what I found out, it was horrendously inefficient. By the time you turn on a light bulb in your house or make a piece of toast or whatever you do with electricity in your house, charge your car. By the way, an electric car that gets its energy from nuclear or coal-based power is worse than simply burning the gasoline. It's a much bigger polluter because it's a much more inefficient process than burning the fuel directly in an automobile. But the goal is to someday have wind generation provide the maximum amount of energy for all of our uses. One of the main problems is that when you see the hillside, the countryside, littered with three-blade wind generators, they simply don't work. And it's my contention is that they were designed not to work. They were designed to be a failure. In my book, The McCanny Wing Generator World Energy Project, I talk about the fact that alternative energy is a myth. There was a myth promulgated in the energy industry, and it was primarily to placate the public that wind energy or solar energy would somehow take over someday and be our source of energy. When the problem with solar, of course, is that the sun only shines a number of hours per day. So as a result, if you were going to use solar, you have to have a much bigger installation because the sun is only there a few hours a day, and then you need a massive storage system with voluminous energy storage capacity to run your electrical needs during the times when the sun is not available. Wind does not have that problem. Wind blows day and night, North Pole, South Pole, doesn't matter if it's winter or summer. The wind is blowing all the time, and it has more than sufficient energy to provide our energy needs. The only problem is the systems that have been developed to capture the wind energy are horrendously inefficient and simply don't work. And so there's many reasons for why they don't work. So what I developed was a system that is a highly efficient system for gathering energy from the wind. It's called the Mecani Wing Generator. I encourage you to look into this. But there is hope. But in the meantime, we're going to have to continue using high energy content fuels. And that's why I agree with putting our energy basis back in the Western Hemisphere, using locally available resources, and then weaning off of these as the wing energy, not wind energy, but wing energy becomes available. And if you understand that system, you will understand why I differentiate between the so-called wind generators with D and my wing generator with G, because it's a totally different system. It's a totally different concept. So there is hope. There is hope that we will someday run our entire energy economy from the wind. And I would estimate that within 10 years, with a concerted effort, we could actually be there. I want to turn my attention now to what I call emotion in science. The entire global climate change narrative has revolved around emotion, getting the people involved emotionally. And one thing that bothers me when I talk to people who are emotionally involved in the idea of global climate change is the level of emotion. And science, okay, I get emotional about science. I get very emotional about some of the science work that I've done. But it has been sold. The idea of global climate change has been sold on emotion. And so that's one of the major problems. Another problem is that the science of linking global climate change to you driving your SUV up and down the road simply is not there. Now, let me give another example. Imagine that I claim that the temperature of the Earth is related to the rising price of refrigerators, and that I'm going to convince you of that. You would say, well, what's the cause and relationship between price of refrigerators and global warming? Well, then I would be beset on a journey to try and figure out why I think that. What is the relation, the cause and effect relationship? And of course, the magic wand that scientists use to relate carbon or carbon-related molecules in the atmosphere and global warming is the greenhouse effect. This brings us back to really the 1970s, when NASA first went to the planet Venus. They expected Venus to be an Earth-like planet, because all we could tell from Earth was that the cloud tops indicated that down below it probably should be a cool planet. Not a lot of sunlight penetrates those highly reflective cloud tops of Venus. That's why Venus, the evening star, is extremely bright in the night sky. But they expected Venus to be at least Earth-like or possibly cooler. And of course, it's a little bit nearer the sun, but end result, they never expected it to be steaming hot. So they had to come up with a scientific excuse. And immediately out of the box, there was a guy named Carl Sagan who said that he believed it was due to the greenhouse effect. In other words, if on a hot day you are in your car and you close all the windows and you leave the air conditioning off, you know that the sunlight comes in, the energy from the visible sunlight changes into infrared, and the windows block the light from getting the infrared light from getting back out. So we call this the greenhouse effect. The problem with it acting in the atmosphere is that there are other factors. And what they're really observing, for example, on a cloudy night, is that the clouds in the atmosphere have a lot more moisture, and they, in fact, maintain heat. And so the temperature does not fluctuate as much. If you're on a desert in the middle of the night and it's very dry, the temperature drops very quickly because there's no heat content in the atmosphere. It's not due to a greenhouse effect or lack thereof. But back to Venus. Venus has a very high content of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And what they found were contradictory evidence. Data that suggested that the night side of Venus was the same temperature as the daytime side of Venus. And when they actually landed on the planet Venus, there are no winds, none at all, at the surface of Venus. So there's no mechanism to bring the warmth from the sunward side of Venus around to the nighttime side of Venus. And Venus has a very slow rotation rate, and so the day on Venus is very long. This is another indicator, and this is something that's very important for people to understand, just the general population, that during the daytime, the temperature can be 20 degrees, 10 degrees higher than the nighttime. So during the nighttime, the Earth loses temperature in your locality. That's a good indicator that we don't have a climate. If we had a climate, that wouldn't happen because the Earth would be able to maintain its temperature through day and night. Venus has a climate because during day and night, the temperature stays the same, the amount of heat content stays the same, the parameters of the atmosphere, the carbon dioxide, the composition of the atmosphere stays the same day and night. So Venus, it would be safe to say, has a climate. Earth does not have a climate because if it's raining where you are, your temperature will tend to be more stable during the night than if you're in a very dry place like the desert. So once again, it depends. Temperature is not a measure of climate. Simply put, I'll say it again, temperature is not a measure or related in any way to climate. It is simply one of many, many factors related to heat content, and the heat content is related to climate. So as the Earth warms up, in other words, the heat content of the Earth rises because we're coming out of an ice age, and slowly the Earth is warming up, all we're doing is getting back to normal. So we are heading into a period of normalcy, not into some kind of dangerous situation where the Earth is going to boil away and we're all going to die. The other thing is, the Earth has a self-regulating mechanism. If it gets too warm, there's more water evaporation, which causes clouds, which maintains the surface temperature a bit cooler, actually, not warmer. The problem with the greenhouse effect is that it's not like your automobile or literally a greenhouse that's enclosed by glass. The atmosphere has a way of relieving temperature, unlike the greenhouse. So the greenhouse analogy is incorrect because it's not a solid glass plate. There are other problems with the greenhouse effect, thermodynamic issues, in that to create the high temperature at the surface of Venus for the light to come in, change to infrared, and then go up and be absorbed by the clouds and then be directed back down to the surface of the planet, this contradicts the second law of thermodynamics. It would be like asking you to open your refrigerator on a warm day and keep your beer cold. That would be the equivalent of what they're trying to pawn off with the greenhouse effect. So like I say, the greenhouse effect, if it does not work on Venus with the massive CO2 atmosphere of Venus, then it certainly is not going to work on Earth that has a minuscule atmosphere of CO2. Many scientists have pointed out that we actually need more CO2. We would have a much better plant growth on Earth if we had a higher CO2. In fact, many greenhouses add CO2 to the atmosphere of their greenhouses to double and triple the growth of plants in a contained environment. So oxygen and CO2, an increase in CO2 would actually be a good thing for planet Earth, not a bad thing. So the idea of using the greenhouse effect, although remember, they don't say greenhouse effect anymore at all. They talk about carbon-related global warming. That's the term they use because nobody wants to talk about greenhouse effect. Because in the scientific community, in the serious scientific community, the greenhouse effect died a very disturbing death many, many decades ago. And in fact, it was rather comical when Carl Sagan, when they came back and said, Carl, the greenhouse effect doesn't account for the high temperature of Venus. He came back and he's a month later and he goes, ah, it's the exaggerated greenhouse effect. They actually use that term to try and bolster the idea of greenhouse effect working at Venus. But the end result is if the greenhouse effect does not work at Venus with its massive CO2 atmosphere, then it certainly does not work on Earth at all. So that's why nobody says greenhouse effect anymore, you'll notice. But they refer to it in a subtle way when they talk about carbon-based global warming or global climate change. The end result also is that in the last few years, the Earth has actually been cooling. When I talk about emotionalism in this global climate change dialogue, the picture of the polar bear on a little iceberg, and everybody's, oh, the poor polar bear, we got to save the polar bear. Well, the end result was that polar bear was taken in the springtime when that's the typical conditions there. But they use that, or emotional. I see a lot of emotion coming from scientists. And like I say, it's good to be emotional, but they're using emotion to cover where they don't have scientific evidence. That's the problem. That is the problem. So I'm about out of time here. I want to thank you for listening. As I said, this will reach many more people than my normal show broadcast, news media, etc. Just remember my webpage, jmccsci.com. The books, the DVDs, the CDs, all the other information. And, of course, the water filters, the JMCC water filter line of products. I believe the sale is still on the webpage. Go there, take advantage of that. That will be coming down soon. Thank you for listening. This is James McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.